With a $5 meal deal with new McValue. You pick a McDouble or a McChicken, then get a small fry, a small drink, and a four-piece McNuggets. That's a lot of McDonald's for not a lot of money.
Prices and participation may vary. McDouble meal, $6 in some markets for a limited time only.
With new McValue at McDonald's, you get more than you expect. So after a long day, buy a double cheeseburger and add a McChicken for a dollar. Because saving with deals is always on the menu with new McValue.
Prices and participation may vary. Valid for item of equal or lesser value.
I knew we'd won. And I'm never optimistic like this with court cases. I've been in too many where the jury or the decision has gone the wrong way. But I knew we'd won.
Do you think this is the last cry of the kind of trans misogyny?
These misogynists have not changed their minds one bit. None of them thought that trans women were women or trans men are men. Everyone knows that's not true. They've wanted to call us particular words and stop us from getting a bit above our station, and they couldn't because that wasn't cool. But they can now. Well, at least they could. This is the beginning of the end.
Hello, welcome back to the Brendan O'Neill Show with me, Brendan O'Neill, and my special guest this week, Julie Bindle. Julie, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Brendan. It's a pleasure.
I can't believe it's taken this long to get you on my podcast. I feel quite ashamed of that, actually.
Yeah, I figured you'd been no-platforming me or something.
Yeah, joining all the trans people and not giving you a platform.
That's right.
I'm very happy that we can rectify it today, not least because you've got this excellent new book out, which is called Lesbians, Where Are We Now? I love that title. Although I think it could just be called Lesbians, which would be maybe even more fantastic.
Yeah.
But it's a good question as to where lesbians are right now. And it ties in nicely with a lot of stuff that's going on at the moment with the Supreme Court ruling. We've suddenly been told by these five judges what a woman is. We've suddenly been told that lesbians can actually gather together if they want to without the presence of a penis. So good stuff is happening. So I guess to kick off, where are lesbians now? Is it getting better? Is it getting worse? How do you see it?
Well, it's got so much worse than it had over recent decades. I came out in the 1970s as a teenager. And of course, then we had no legal rights. We had no recourse to the law. There was no such thing as discrimination towards lesbians. You could be, and I was, kicked out of jobs and places where I'd rented to live. Suffered all kinds of prejudice and discrimination. But then things got better for the simple reason that we, the women's liberation movement, the gay and lesbian liberation movement, campaigned and changed hearts and minds and pushed through legislation that was necessary at the time to equalise our status. We didn't ever ask for the rights of other groups of people. We simply wanted them for ourselves. And then things started to go downhill with the advent of queer theory dominating universities and luxury beliefs that were taken up by those with more privilege and time on their hands than they needed. And of course, we then saw the advent of micro-identities, identity politics, narcissism, basically, that seemed to take precedence over what lesbians and gay men were fighting to achieve, which was equality and liberation. And that's why what was the lesbian and gay rights movement expanded to the LGBTQQI2 spirit plus, which is pretty much where we are now, although I'm told that you have to have the two spirit first. And as Simon Fanshawe has said, it's like an unbreakable Wi-Fi code, not any kind of acronym. And so where we've ended up is bottom of the pile amongst those that, when you get south of the B of the bisexual, is mainly heterosexuals, including a lot of heterosexual kinkster men who consider themselves to be part of a rainbow coalition and part of some kind of oppressed rainbow, which is nonsense. So lesbians are at the bottom of the heap. We have needed to fight back against this tidal wave of misogyny that comes thick and fast at us, even more so sometimes than it does other women. And we needed an amicable divorce from the rest of the acronym. Gay men have largely understood this. The others don't understand the thing because they're just queer idiots with interesting hair colours. And that's why, when I started writing the book, I decided that it would have to be about fighting back against what has been the biggest onslaught against our rights in my lifetime, which is the gender ideology and all of the liberals who took it up and basically threw us under the bus.
Yeah, I want to really dig into that because, you know, if I look back 15 or 20 years ago, I wouldn't have had on my bingo card that we would go through this period of extreme homophobia where, you know, lesbians in particular got the real brunt of that. So I really want to dig down into that with you and what that represents. But just to stay with the Supreme Court ruling to begin with, because I do want to get your thoughts and maybe even your feelings about this, because listeners will be familiar that the Supreme Court has ruled in favour of the heroines of Four Women Scotland, who took the Scottish government to court because the Scottish government thinks you a man with a piece of paper becomes a woman. And these women said, don't be ridiculous. That's anti-women, anti-truth, anti-science. And they won, which was brilliant. Tell us a bit about your response, because I know you were involved in this issue. You've been involved in it for many years. I think you were at the court on the day that it was the ruling came. Tell us a bit about what it was like and how the women there were feeling when they heard that ruling being read out.
Well, to go back a little bit to the time when the case was argued, I was in court then, because the Lesbian Project that I founded with Kathleen Stock, in order to address the terrible things that were happening to lesbians, at best the marginalisation compared to other so-called oppressed minorities. We were interveners in the case, along with Scottish Lesbians and LGB Alliance, because we needed to make it clear to the court that what we were seeing, if they took the wrong decision, in other words, that a man with a piece of paper can be legally a woman, therefore a lesbian, if he's a straight man, was the eradication of our sexual orientation. And I don't mean in the hysterical, ridiculous way that trans activists suggest that we are eradicating their entire lives and identities. I mean actually deciding that lesbians were no longer same-sex attracted females, but were simply same gender attracted, and anyone, including those, as you say, with a penis, could be involved in the club. And so it would have resulted in a gathering of any more than 25 lesbians not being allowed to turn away a lesbian with a penis and a piece of paper, or a piece of paper on his penis, who knows? And of course, the other interesting thing about the this so-called gender recognition certificate that makes a man who decides he is a woman in law is that you're not allowed to ask this person to produce their gender recognition certificate, or even if they've got one, because that's seen as discrimination. So any bloke can turn up. You could turn up. It doesn't matter how you present physically, how you behave. You're a lesbian if you say you are. So we intervened and I was in court for the arguments, and you could see the way, and I write about this in my book, you could see the way that the KC, who was representing the Scottish ministers, because the case was against the Scottish ministers, was desperately trying to convince the finest legal minds in the land that Pete could come along to a lesbian gathering and say he is a legal lesbian and he has to be let in. But that when John comes along and doesn't have a piece of paper, legally they don't need to let him in. These are two identical twins, and you're not allowed to ask about the piece of paper. So she was using phrases to the judges such as, when the trans woman becomes the sex of their acquired gender, and kept tripping over herself, because of course that phrase has no meaning whatsoever, and then was really edging to be let out of that courtroom early for lunch. She was edging to be let out a good half an hour before they usually rise for lunch. And I almost felt sorry for her. I didn't quite make it, but I almost did. And it was hearing the questions put forward by the judges about the chilling effect, which is what we'd submitted in our intervention, on lesbians not being able to be 26 lesbians. In fact, I want to open a club called 26 Lesbians. It was the way that they were asking about the chilling effect, And the way that she couldn't respond except for to say, well, it would be legal for 26 lesbians to meet if it was over a philosophical belief. For example, if everybody's gender critical. So I know some trans-identified people, some men, who actually agree with feminists that you can't change sex and it's bonkers. For whatever reason, they chose to live as the opposite sex and the medical profession thought it was sanity to assist them in doing so. But they agree with us. So we would have to let in one of those nice, reasonable trans women, in other words, men, unless we decided that we were a philosophical group where we all believed something like, I don't know, asbestos is really good for the lungs. But then if a man came along of any sort and said that he also believed this, we'd also have to let him in. So by the time the KC retired for lunch and probably needed some smelling salts, I knew we'd won. And I'm never optimistic like this with court cases. I've been in too many where the jury or the decision has gone the wrong way. But I knew we'd won. And I was unequivocal on this. And that was it. The lesbians won it. I don't mean because the other submissions weren't utterly brilliant. They were. And their barristers. For Women Scotland, as you say, heroes, sex matters, producing the most coherent arguments and literature on this issue and have been for some time. LGB allies, all of them were brilliant, but I knew it would be the lesbian argument that would win it because that's where it's the starkest, most bonkers, Orwellian, swivel-headed madness.
I completely agree because as soon as you start talking about a lesbian with a penis, you know that you've crossed over into the realm of, I guess, lunacy, just outright madness. No one, you know, it wouldn't have made sense to anyone 10 or 15 years ago to have such an idea. But just on the case, I think the ruling is brilliant. I mean, it's kind of like For Women Scotland won on every point. I mean, the judges did not hedge their bets. But so it was a very clear ruling. But at the same time, are you sad that we needed the Supreme Court to tell us what a woman is and what a lesbian is? I mean, how did we get to that situation?
To be honest, I'm very angry. I mean, very angry. So the day that the ruling came in, obviously, although I was confident, it was a relief. Yeah. We were elated. I was so thrilled for those women who are awaiting tribunals or court cases of whatever type or who are at risk of losing their jobs, who are being questioned at the moment by human resources people. And I've long said, you know, someday there'll be something terrible will happen to a human resource office and there'll be no witnesses. But anyway, these people that seem to be leading the charge when it comes to universities and big corporations, I was so relieved for those women that are in fear of losing their jobs. And also women such as Sarah Summers, who's taking Rape Crisis Brighton, of course, Trans Tinseltown, to task over her being effectively kicked out of a sexual assault service because she questioned the fact that there were men in there. But then soon afterwards, there was lots of drinking and celebration that I couldn't take part in because I had to do two podcasts and write three articles. But I did in the evening. I went and saw all of the others. We had, you know, a couple of drinks and shook each other's hands and hugged and kissed. And then the very next day, I was full of rage. And then actually quite depressed, I have to say. Quite low, quite, what's the point? For me, this has been 21 years of just being no platformed and called a bigot and a Nazi and being physically attacked and having to argue with wazooks in universities when they would block me from doing what I was there to do, unpaid, you know. Talks about feminism and male violence, all those wasted years for all those women who did lose their jobs, all those women and some men whose name we will never know, who have been kicked out of friendship groups and God knows what else. The toll has been terrible. And the thing that depressed me was the kids. It was the fact that young people, and obviously in recent years it's been young in the main, same-sex attracted girls, many of whom are autistic, many of whom are suffering trauma through kind of stuff that unfortunately happens to girls. And they have been put on hormones, puberty blockers, hormones. Some of them have had double mastectomies. Many of them have been estranged from their families and their support network. They'll all regret it in the future, and I can say that unequivocally. I made a podcast series, Julie in Genderland, where I interviewed loads of parents, all of them from, you know, whichever side of the sort of left and right you want to go, all of them decent, none of them homophobic, all of them concerned out of care and love for their children, all of whom were desperate to stop their children being transed, some of whom succeeded, most of whom failed before damage had been done, all of whom had been told they were bigots and they'd lose their children if they didn't affirm. They're the ones that I felt really depressed on behalf of. How the hell the liberal masses could support this insidious gay conversion therapy, I do not know.
Saving money on your outdoor project now at Menards. We have everything you need to keep your outdoor power equipment running smooth so you can keep that lawn in tip-top shape or enjoy some time on your boat. Right now, all FVP lawn and garden and marine batteries are on sale through May 5th. Check out our entire selection of FVP batteries today and view our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals. Save big money at
Menards. Hi, it's Brendan here. I just wanted to remind you that you can still buy my latest book. It's called After the Pogrom, 7th of October, Israel and the Crisis of Civilization, and it's available right now from Amazon. I'm really proud of this book. It is an unflinching account of how the West failed the moral test of 7th of October 2023, which of course is the day that Hamas and other militants invaded Israel and unleashed barbarism. The book documents in pretty chilling detail how activists, academics, and others in the West ended up making excuses for Hamas's violence, ended up taking the side of the pogromists against the pogrom's victims, and ended up in the process turning their backs on the values of civilization. The book is fundamentally a call to arms for Western civilization. It makes the case for restoring Enlightenment values and standing with Israel while it's under attack by radical Islamists. I don't know if an author is allowed to describe his own book as essential reading, but I really do think it's essential reading. It's called After the Pogrom, 7th of October, Israel and the Crisis of Civilization, and you can get your copy right now from Amazon.
I mean, when you describe it like that, it's just extraordinary. I mean, it's got to be one of the most destructive movements of modern time.
Yes,
where you
yes,
have,
yes.
You know, it's like the lobotomy of the modern era, but in some ways even worse, because you have these young people who might have autism or might just be lesbians or might just be gay kids, whatever. And they're being put on this conveyor belt of drugging and mutilation and a life of loneliness often. I mean, it is just unspeakably awful. Just to tie it in with some of the themes in your book, and I want to ask you some questions about the book, of course. Would you say that what you've experienced, as you say, over the past 21 years, where you've been trying to, often completely on your own, certainly to begin with, you've been making the case that the trans ideology is misogynistic and has a destructive impact on women and lesbians' rights. Do you think this period that you've been through and lots of other people have been through is the worst attack on lesbian rights of your lifetime? Because your book really does a stand-up job of documenting the oppression of lesbians, the discrimination against them, the victories they've won over the past 50 years, the transformations that have taken place, and then this extraordinary backlash. Is this the worst period of it, do you think, that you've lived through?
By a wide margin. And bearing in mind, and I'm not the bravest feminist I know, there are many women out there that leave me open-mouthed at what they have been willing to take on and go through. You know, there are extraordinary women, I mean, in countries around the world where we can't even imagine daily life. But I have stood up against misogynistic bullies. I have stood up against threats of violence and really quite nasty groups of men. But the only time that I've ever capitulated through being bullied, through fear, through being worn down, being actually quite traumatized by it now that I look back, was against a horrible trans activist called Paris Lees. and I write about this in the book, I was the one that made an approach to say, look, can't we build bridges? And we were both working for the same media company. And I just made an approach. I've been trying to talk to other trans activists. And before the trans elders decided this was not a good move, because actually once we got in a room together, even if we would never agree, at least it was before no debate, we could actually have the discussion about how this was harmful for women's rights and how they shouldn't be encroaching on our rights. But we, of course, would respect the way that they wish to live. These were the good old days, right? Before 2015. But I made a huge mistake in talking to Paris Lees, and I just caved in. I caved in a way that I would never have caved in any other circumstances with any other man who was bullying. I would have probably punched him in the face, quite frankly. But in order to get out of that room and to get away from, I think, what had really become too much at that stage, it was back in 2012, I just agreed. Yeah, of course men can be lesbians if they're in a relationship together. I just went along with it, left the room, and just thought, I'll never, ever do this again. And I never did. I never, ever sat down and had a conversation with an opponent on this. And yet, you know, I've been, and after that, I was arguing on TV in Northern Ireland about equal marriage, about gay rights, lesbian rights, with men and women who told us that we should have been drowned at birth. And talking about equal marriage, like marrying your vacuum cleaner, which, you know, I mean, is both funny and deeply offensive. But so that was a personal story about how I know from my point of view how insidious and vile and misogynistic this movement is, because I did capitulate that one time. But looking at the broader picture, of course, I see on a regular basis young lesbians who have been bullied out of using the word lesbian. It took us a long time to get to like that word. When I came out in my teens, it was the worst word on the planet. It was horrific. We would use any word but that. We would say bisexual, we would say gay, or we wouldn't use terms at all. It's gone back to that for young lesbians. We've been told that we should be dragged off pride marches by our saggy tits. That's a quote from a gay man addressing the crowd at one of the pride marches at the end of, I think it was 2018-19, when a group called Get the L Out decided that we were no longer going to have, you know, there was minor attracted persons, MAPS, as the euphemism was for child abusers. And then there were the whole trans lunatic lot, and everyone but lesbians was being given attention and credit for fighting the good fight. And yes, I've never seen anti-lesbian bigotry like it. It actually became a descriptor for transphobic. I heard young lesbians at universities, in friendship groups, online, say things like, well, I don't use the word lesbian because it's a dog whistle. By the way, another term I hate. I've come to hate all of these dog whistles, ally. I can't bear any of them.
Yeah.
But yeah, lesbian became a dog whistle for transphobia.
I mean, it's extraordinary. It really is extraordinary. And I remember that Paris Lees conversation that you talked about, and which you mentioned in the book as well. And you still get flack for that now. And I often think to myself, listen, at that time, Julie was very much out there on her own, getting abuse from everyone. You know, if she did capitulate in that one circumstance, as you say, that's understandable. I think it's incredibly uncharitable that people look back on that and kind of hold it. Well, some people try to hold it against you. Let's talk about this a little bit in the history of the lesbian fight in the UK, which you talk about in your book, and you talk about your role in it, which was very central. People will know that you played a central role in the struggle for women's rights and lesbian rights in the UK. One thing that struck me about your book, I kind of knew this, or I had a feeling, but it sounds like being a lesbian was difficult in the UK for quite some time, but it was also fun. I mean, that sounds like a ridiculous thing to say, but you do talk about how, you know, this was not the kind of movement that might have been caricatured in the tabloids in the 70s and 80s, a bunch of kind of morose, you know, self-obsessed depressed lesbians in dungarees or whatever the image might have been. It was actually quite a interesting, fun, provocative movement. Can you explain what that kind of contradiction, I guess, between the difficulty of being a lesbian in the 70s and the 80s and also the sense of aspiration or fun or pleasure that came with it as well?
There really was. And this is because, of course, we have had to have good senses of humour, because the things that happen to us and that we're accused of are ridiculous.
Yeah.
And at the same time, we had a camaraderie with gay men where we could joke with each other. It was absolutely de rigueur to call each other dykes and shirtlifters and God knows what. Of course, you know, had outsiders done that with malice, then we would have had something to say. But, it, you know, we were always, you know, very clear that in order to get through the difficulties in our daily lives, and some had more difficulties than others, of course, being raised in families where they wouldn't accept the sexual orientation of their child, or being in the workplace where they were scared that it would come out that they were lesbian or gay. But lesbians always had lots of fun. We were the first ones, actually, through feminism and through looking at critiquing the nuclear family, that genuinely tried what the kids today would call polyamory. We called it non-monogamy. And let's just be honest, it didn't work, right? It was a failed experiment where you could have more than one sexual partner at a time. The insecurity and jealousy was off the scale. We're quite different emotionally to gay men in that sense. But we did try it. We lived in groups together in houses, in communes, and helped raise each other's kids. And we would go out to a bar or a pub or a club to be amongst each other on a very regular basis, because, of course, it wasn't as it then became, which was great, which was that we could just hang out more mainstream, and that we were no longer seen as the pariahs that we had been. And therefore, we were invited to and wanted to go along to more mixed groups. At that time, it was pretty impossible to do. So there was lots of ways in which lesbians would have great times together, and often, and it didn't always work out this way, but we cared very much for each other in general, and we would inevitably split up with our ex. And after a period of shouting and throwing things in the street, we would then become friends, and she would be the ex of somebody else who you were also friends with. And you'd end up around a dinner table where all of you had some connection that had continued through these times. So friendship lines were also very strong. And of course, when it was easier for us to have children as lesbians, as lesbian couples, and have some legal protection for those children and for ourselves as parents, although it wasn't anything, I never wanted to do that, then that meant that you would be part of each other's lives in a way that wasn't just the conventional, well, Mark and Alice are going out tonight with Peter and Susan, and they see Peter and Susan every Sunday night, and their children are friends together. You know, we had a less conventional lifestyle than that, and it did make it more interesting.
One thing I found interesting in your book is the divide that there existed for a period of time between lesbians who talked about being born this way. You know, that's what they are. It's natural, it's inherited, or it's genetic, whatever. And that's an ongoing discussion, of course, mm-hmm. popularized to some extent by Lady Gaga's song Born This Way, which became an anthem a few years back. And then the view of lesbianism as something that might be not necessarily adopted, but something that could be weaved a bit more into a broader identity or a political identity, or I guess a social identity. I found that really interesting because I think it does tap into some of the discussions that are ongoing now. And of course, it touches on the whole theme of your book, which is what are lesbians? Who are lesbians? Where are they now? What's going on with them? Talk to us a little bit about that divide and why you thought that was an important one.
Well, if there had been a gay gene, it would have been discovered by now, because scientists have been looking at this, and millions and millions of dollars have been spent in the search for an explanation as to why we're lesbian or gay. And I do believe that sexual attraction is very hardwired at a really quite young age. And I'm 100% against actual conversion therapy. In fact, I've done it as an undercover journalist, and it's terrible. And the reason that many gay men adopt this, well, we're born that way, we can't help it, is as an argument against conversion therapy. I think conversion therapy is immoral. I think it's cruel and vindictive and unnecessary. And I think they're the only arguments that we need when we're saying that we shouldn't be sent to a therapist to be talked out of our sexual attraction. On the other hand, I also don't think that I've never known personally a lesbian who is not attracted, sexually attracted and emotionally attracted to women, but who decides that she's going to come out as a lesbian anyway. But she may be very political about it. So there may well be, and I have met these women, women who know that they're attracted sexually and emotionally, could fall in love with another woman, hasn't had a sexual relationship with a woman for whatever reason, will proudly refer to herself as a lesbian because she's proud of being part of that tribe, which is quite a challenge to patriarchal orthodoxy. We're the only sexual orientation that rejects male sexuality, for example. And we're not lesbians because of that. But this is something that we have to contend with. It can be quite irritating to men, some men, who decide that women shouldn't reject them sexually. And maybe that's why girl-on-girl porn is such a popular genre. Who knows? But I do think that the born this way argument, in order to say we deserve our rights because we can't help it, you should tolerate us because we're just like redheads, we can't help it, is actually quite offensive. Also, females can't help being female. For black people, that's immutable. But that argument hasn't helped them in fighting against prejudice. So I'd like to leave that argument alone because I find it quite cowardly and a little bit pathetic, and instead just say, yeah, of course it's great being a lesbian, I'm proud of being a lesbian. I used to be asked all the time in my youth, if you could take a pill to make you straight, would you? And at that time I probably said I would, because I was being asked in a bullying, threatening fashion. But my God, no, I wouldn't. I love being a lesbian. But that doesn't mean to say I've chosen it despite not being attracted to other women. Of course I am, of course that's why I'm a lesbian. So I just think we should get a bit more pride back in how we talk about ourselves and our orientation. And I do think that there is a big divide between the way that gay men and lesbians fought, for example, against Section 28. The lesbians were demanding rights, doing great stunts like scaling, abseiling down the House of Lords and tying themselves to Sue Lawley's chair at the BBC and all of those brilliant direct actions. I was involved in one at the Ideal Home exhibition in London, compared to gay men who really were doing this, poor me, I'm a victim, we can't help it, just be nice to us, we want to be the same as you, we wish we were. I'm glad I'm not.
Yeah, that's all you need to say in terms of, you know, defending yourself and your group. You just need to say, whatever, this is what we are, take it or leave it. It's interesting to, there's a brilliant subheading in the book, which is the diminishing hideousness of lesbians. And you talk about how the fortunes of lesbians have changed in public discussion, I guess. And I did want to ask you about the double-edged nature of that. So you talk about how for a long period in the 20th century, lesbians were presented as ugly. You use the word unfuckable, you know, and it was, you say that it was very often a warning to heterosexual women, you know, stay away from these women or you'll end up an ugly old frump like them. That was the kind of, that was the lesbian approach, that was the approach to lesbians for a long time. Their fortunes changed, as you say, the hideousness diminished. And I guess we found ourselves propelled into an era in which a kind of exoticness attached itself to being a lesbian. So you mentioned their lesbian porn, which is scarily popular, I guess, on the internet. We also have lesbian chic that's been going around for some time. I think the most recent example of it was Charlie XCX and Billie Eilish, their song about underpants or whatever.
Yeah.
Lots of lesbian undertones and overtones. What have you made of that? So lesbians have gone from being, if you'll excuse my language, unfuckable to fuckable. But is that a victory? What's happening there?
Well, Lesbian Chic had its moment back in, I think it was the early 90s, when there was the infamous cover of, oh gosh, it wasn't Vogue, and I don't remember the magazine, and I should, with K.D. Lang in a chair having a pseudo shave by Cindy
Crawford. Yeah. Vanity
That's
Fair.
That's right. That's right, Vanity Fair. And, you know, it was, look, it was a great moment for, it was tongue-in-cheek for lots of lesbians who felt that they didn't see any good representation or role models, and there was no fun about lesbians or lesbianism at all. It was all either sleazy or completely condemnatory. That's great. But it never lasts. It didn't last. And lesbians haven't really had our moment, to be honest. You know, we've never really properly been in Vogue. And I'm very happy with that, because I just want to the bullying and the accusations of bigotry to stop. You know, I want lesbians to be seen as part of, you know, a proud women's liberation movement where we have our right, the rights that we deserve, and don't feel that we have to creep through life apologizing for ourselves. That would be wonderful. And I do think that gay men have had their moment. It's quite sad for me to think about the fact that the very first and only at that time great lesbian role model, Martina Navratilova, is pretty much still the only one. I don't mean that there aren't other lesbians that have come out that are in popular culture, that are represented in soaps, really important stuff. There are others. But looking at sport, for example, where Martina stands, there aren't really many others. If you look at the gender horror of the past couple of decades, how many feminist and lesbian sporting icons have done what Martina's done, which is say, come on, you know, we've got female sport for a reason. This is outrageous that you're suggesting putting natal males in a boxing ring or a tennis court with women. So there still aren't those women that are willing to stand up and kick ass. And yeah, I mean, there's the role models who are great because they're lesbians and they dress really cool and they're conventionally, you know, gorgeous. That's all great. That's important. But the ones I think that we really value and look up to and aspire to and get confidence from are the likes of Martina Navratilova.
This year, Spiked is celebrating its 25th birthday. 25 years ago, Spiked was a pioneer of online political journalism. And now we are bigger than ever. We're reaching people around the world with our articles, essays, videos, and podcasts, all underpinned by our principled message of freedom, democracy, and progress. This would never have happened without you, our listeners, readers, and supporters. Your donations fund our work, and your enthusiasm spreads the word about it. So as we mark Spiked's 25th birthday, we want to say a heartfelt thank you. And we're asking those who can afford it to donate to our anniversary appeal in order to keep Spiked going and growing into the future. We also have a very special offer on at the moment. Those who donate £25 or more will get a year's membership to Spike Supporters, our online donor community, where you can comment on articles, come to events, and read the site ad-free. This is half of what you'd normally pay for a year's membership. And if you're already a Spike supporter, you can benefit from this offer too. Just make a donation of £25 or more and we'll extend your membership by 12 months. So if you want to support Spiked and get access to some brilliant exclusive perks, go to spiked-online.com/donate. That's spiked-online.com/donate and donate £25 or more to help keep us going for another 25 years.
Yeah, I think, that's a point very well made. And what Martina has done over the past few years has been extraordinary. I mean, just really out there making the case for women against the trans lunacy. In your book, there's one line that I just never thought I'd have to read a line like this, but you say, the subheading is how I define a lesbian. And you say, my definition of a lesbian is a woman, i.e. female, who is sexually attracted to other women, i.e. other females. Did you ever think you would have to write a sentence like that? Because, you know, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, 50 years ago, whether people hated lesbians or thought they were fine, whether they were phobic or accepting, everyone knew what a lesbian was. And so when you wrote that sentence, did you have a moment where you thought, what is going on here? Why am I having to tell people what a lesbian is?
I really did. There are times when you have to say what a lesbian isn't or what a lesbian doesn't do. And occasionally, it's, you know, not all lesbians eat cigars. But serious, I mean, some I'm sure do. But I just thought, oh my God, what on earth is this? But you see, that came from me sitting and staring at a blank screen for about 3 months trying to write this book. Because I was determined in the first instance, I had to ask for an extension for those 3 months, to write a book about lesbians that didn't go into the gender shit. And I couldn't. And then I thought to myself, why? Why would I even think I could at this moment in time write a book about lesbians that doesn't go into the gender shit? What am I going to do? Lesbian fashion in the northeast of England. You know, a 62-year-old woman's take. I mean, it had to be about the biggest threat to our lives, liberty, liberation, and well-being that we've ever faced. But it also had to be a book that didn't mess around, that clearly defined the parameters in terms of what we have gained and what we're in danger of losing, and how, in my view, we need to get back to that, to get back to the real nitty-gritty of protest and saying we're not standing for it, rather than being forced by the bullies into just sucking it up. And there are so many young lesbians that I've met, some of who don't want to listen to me or talk to me, and that's fine. But some of whom do, who've come up to me at public events and said, oh, Julie, by the way, my name's X. I'm really sorry, but I was one of the group that ended up getting you barred from, and then fill in the name of any university, right, over the last 15 or so years. And I now think I was a complete dickhead, and I'm really sorry that I did that. And I was in the LGBTQI plus group, and it was led by a man, and, you know, it was really creepy. There was loads of so-called trans women all making sexual advances to us. And actually, here we are now. And yeah, we came out of that. Oh, no, this event is great and nice to meet you. And there's loads of young lesbians like that now. But I'm afraid we did have to redraw our boundaries. And that's what it's been about. And that's why the Supreme Court decision is so useful. Because that, of course, the law hasn't changed. It's just been clarified. That can now be used by pub landlords, venue managers, who previously have agreed to cancel events that have been booked by feminists, sometimes lesbian groups, where they've caved into the trans activists because they think that they will face a legal challenge from them if they don't. And now, of course, what we can say to these people, including employers, is, oh, no, you don't need to sack that person. You don't need to cancel that group. You don't need to stop that conference from going ahead, because actually the law is on your side. And here's what you say to them when they email you threatening all kinds of nonsense against you. You just say, oh, no, we'd be contravening the Equality Act. We can't do that.
Yeah, it's brilliant. That in itself is a very valuable development. One thing that has struck me, I've been thinking about this recently, is that when I was growing up, and I'm old enough to remember that you would sometimes hear people say, oh, what that lesbian needs is a good seeing to. You know, if she had a man, a man could fix her. Sex with a man would sort her out. You'd often hear that prejudice around. And now you hear that again with the trans ideology, because although in some ways it's even more insidious now, because what people now say to young lesbians in particular is that if you don't sleep with this trans woman, i.e. man, then you're a bigot. Stonewall even likens it to a form of sexual racism. You're something pathologically wrong with you. Why won't you sleep with this woman, i.e. man? So there's a real commonality there, isn't there, in terms of the bigotry and pressure that is put on lesbians to stop being lesbians, essentially.
You're right. It's a new and insidious, even more insidious form of misogyny and anti-lesbianism. Recently, I was away in Southeast Europe in a village working. Let's just say that the attitudes there towards women in this particular place were a little bit backward. I was in a bar at the end of the evening with a couple of colleagues, and drunken sexist bloke started, "Yeah, hello, gorgeous, you know, come out with me, I'll show you a good time." And they went from that to dirty lesbian within seconds. And do you know something? It was really refreshing. I felt nostalgic for that old style sexism. I thought, oh, hello, I recognise you. Right? No one is going to say what this man has just said to these three women just having a drink quietly at the bar was okay. No one's going to blame you as being a bigot when you tell them how dare you. Everybody knows their role in this place. He knew he was an arsehole. The barman and the other customers in there thought he was out of order. We knew where it came from. Sorted. Old style sexism. But now you haven't just got trans activists saying, "Yes, I'm a lesbian. How dare you focus on my genitals," meaning he's got a dick. And the likes of Owen Jones and others, oh, just absolute hideous men, including Billy Bragg, who dares to dictate to women and to lesbians as to who we should accept in our dating pool. Where my friend Lucy Massoud, a lesbian who was a firefighter and is now a barrister, when she was kicked off Hinge, which is a lesbian dating site, for saying she was only interested in biological females and called a bigot and a transphobe. Oh my God, the blue fringe idiots, the Owen Joneses of this world would have had her as the bigot. That's how Orwellian and crazy. But you see, these men, the Joneses and the Braggs of the world, they've wanted to say, in my view, they've wanted to hurl this abuse at women for a long time. There's a particular sexism of men on the left, which is they've wanted to call us particular words and stop us from getting a bit above our station, and they couldn't because that wasn't cool. But they can now. Well, at least they could. This is the beginning of the end.
Yeah, I think it is the beginning of the end. When I think about some of the movements that have contributed to the beginning of the end and this turnaround that we're all living through, you mentioned Sex Matters earlier. Of course, there's For Women Scotland as well, and there's the Lesbian Project, which you run with Kathleen Stock. There's LGB Alliance, and you mentioned Get the L Out, who've done some really good stunts and protests at Pride marches and other places. When I think about the Lesbian Project and the LGB Alliance and Get the L Out, the thing that I find so extraordinary is that these kind of groups are often referred to as hate groups,
yes. I mean,
especially the LGB Alliance. The LGB Alliance has openly been referred to as a hate group by many left wingers, and there have been campaigns to get it defunded and to get it banned and to have its meetings banned.
Yeah,
I mean, it really is just, it's kind of reminiscent of what neo-fascists would have done in the 1970s, which is, you know, fight back against gay liberation. I mean, it really is that extraordinary, isn't it?
It is. And we've had recently one of the swivel-headed lunatics that make up the Green Party, Maggie Chapman, almost calling the Supreme Court a transphobic hate group. I mean, really? Yeah. Mad. And they like book burning. They love No Debate. I mean, No Debate is over. No Debate clearly was over when they realised it was not sustainable and we were taking all of the cases to court and winning. They realised that this had been a terrible, terrible experiment. But of course, during the No Debate period, what happened was, and we're now seeing eyes opening and ears opening all over the country and elsewhere, was that the ordinary, let's call them civilians, the people around the UK and elsewhere who are neither feminists and lesbians or gay men and fighting against this, or just, you know, decent people with common sense, realising the harm to this, don't want their kids to go through it, or they're trans people living for whatever reason, and I think they've all been failed by the medical profession, but whatever reason, living as the opposite sex and just wanting to live a quiet life. all of these civilians on either side have been denied the exposure to logic, to the argument. So all you would get was a mantra from the trans activists, and they are bullies. They are really nasty dictatorial bullies. And they would trot out this line, this McCarthyite tactic that they used. And of course, we couldn't then get out into the general public, because our meetings were cancelled and we weren't invited onto the BBC and the like, to say, no, 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 you've got it wrong. Listen, this is why it's harmful to us. We're left-wing lesbian feminists. We're not actual fascists and Nazis and bigots. You can't turn an entire group, groups of people who they would say were on the right side of history a decade ago, all of a sudden we've become right-wing Trump supporters who want to strip the rights of women to reproductive rights. It's none of it was logical, but no debate helped them in that way. It really did. But you're right. These people have behaved in ways that, you know, my in-laws lived through McCarthyism. And although they died a few years ago, they saw this stuff as it was building up and said, it's like the McCarthy era in so many ways.
I wanted to ask you how you think the trans ideology and its impact on lesbians and its impact on women and children as well, how does that interplay with other left-wing, kind of woke left obsessions? For example, they are often pro-prostitution, they love porn, or they, you know, they celebrate porn, they celebrate OnlyFans, they think these are very kind of assertive ways of earning a living, and it's wonderful for women to be able to express their sexuality and make money. I mean, these are the arguments they make. I mean, these things are all interlocked, aren't they? Because when I listen to woke leftists, or even kind of neo-feminists, the kind of, I don't know what wave it is, I lose track of the waves, but whatever wave it is that was pro-prostitution, pro-sex work, as they would call it, and pro-porn and pro-trans women are women, all of those things have one thing in common, which is that women lose out as a consequence of all of those industries. So how has it happened where so-called new feminists and the supposed left have embraced an ideology that is measurably, palpably harmful to ordinary women?
Well, let's look at the tick box, shall we? The tick box list that they will support. So trans women are women always leads to sex work is work, always leads to surrogacy is a human right for infertile people. What they mean is gay men. Gay men aren't infertile. Gay men are men. So it becomes a human right. Now, the sex trade and the surrogacy trade are both big business, right? We're talking about billions and billions of dollars off the backs of the most desperate disenfranchised women. With the surrogacy trade, we're also talking about babies being commercialized and commodified and the effect on them, which we're starting to hear about because now they're, you know, some of them have become adults and are speaking out. How can the left support industries that are in many ways more grotesque and exploitative than the tobacco industry? How can they hook themselves up with the worst excesses of capitalism as meets uber patriarchy and say they're on the left? And how can they possibly also start, mind you, I mean, most of them don't know a thing about this topic, but how can they also take the position that Hamas are freedom fighters? It doesn't matter what position you take, and I'm deeply critical of the Israeli government, always have been, but how can anyone decide that because Israel has conducted itself like X, that Hamas is suddenly made up of left-wing freedom fighters and incidentally didn't commit the crimes that they're supposed to have committed on October the 7th. Why do they have to have black and white, good versus bad, in a childish, extremely childlike, naive and deeply offensive way? And so with the sex work nonsense, they think that this is about empowerment for women. Well, I've only ever heard the word empowerment used to describe anything horrible that happens to women and girls. I've never heard anyone say to a man, go on then, Mike, why don't you go and play some golf? It'll be empowering for you. I mean, it's only ever used in that way to excuse horrible things. Same with surrogacy. Well, what about these poor infertile women and the women love being pregnant? It's good for them. Just tell the truth. You're supporting vile, grotesque, capitalistic industries, and you have defied every leftist and liberal principle that you pretend to hold dear. The left has betrayed women. Full stop, end of. I won't go to the right because I don't consider them of the left. I think they're scumbags to support the stuff that they have, which affects women who are cleaners in corporations where they're terrified of opening their mouths about seeing a man with a stiffy in the toilets in case she loses her job. So they are grotesque in their betrayal of working class principles, and they are not, in my view, of the left, and they should never be able to use that descriptor for themselves ever again.
Yeah, very well put. And surrogacy is actually one of the issues on which your writing changed my mind. I mean, I was always iffy about surrogacy, but I wasn't clear what side I came down on. And the stuff that you've been writing over the years has made an impact on how I think about it. And I think what you've said there is absolutely right. Yeah, my view is that if you support, you know, the mutilation of young lesbians and the hiring out of women's bodies to rich men, and if you celebrate prostitution as a good thing when we all know that it's incredibly harmful to the desperate women who sometimes feel they have to do it, if you support all those things, you can't call yourself progressive. There's, you know, that word loses all meaning if you're using it to cover up activities like that. But I just have a couple more questions for you, Julie. The first one is on the fallout from the Supreme Court ruling and the protests that we've seen, which I must say I found them quite hilarious. Hilarious and terrifying at the same time.
P for me, hashtag.
Yeah,
P for me. How to get the public on side. P for me.
Exactly. Hi. And in St. Peter's Square in Manchester, there was a placard saying, I'll pee anywhere I want. This is the place where working class people once gathered for the right to vote. And now you have middle class men gathering for the right to piss in the women's toilet. I mean, what a turnaround. Right. But what about... what do you think that tells us? Do you think this is the last cry of the kind of trans misogyny, or do you think it's proof that they're going to rearm morally and come back? How do you feel it's going to play out?
Well, these misogynists have not changed their minds one bit. None of them thought that trans women were women or trans men are men. Everyone knows that's not true, including the most hardened trans activists. But what they thought was they could take women's rights and do what they wished with them. And we have shown over and over again that they're not going to be allowed to do so. And I said something at my book launch last week about we need to make a film of this. What will it be called? Four Tribunals and a Court Decision. Because it is, we've gone on and on and on saying we are not having this. You're not having these rights. You're just not. And of course they'll cry and scream and spill their juice over their bibs. Of course they will. But we've put up with men sobbing like this before, because they haven't got their own way. We unfortunately have to deal with a lot of very spoilt, just hideously posh women, including some in the Houses of Parliament, who are bleating on about bigotry and poor trans women not, you know, feeling scared in men's prisons or men's toilets without a care or concern for those of us that are the really at risk. Because, of course, they've never had to concern themselves with it because they are upper middle class twats. And so they have choices in life that other women don't. So that this isn't the end, but it is the beginning of the end. But what has shifted and what needs to shift much further, but we're getting there, is, as I said earlier, the liberal masses defending them, staying silent on this, thinking they're on the right side of history, going along with it because they're too cowardly or too ignorant or too lazy to think about what this so-called culture war, which it never was, is really about. Once the liberal masses stop giving them carte blanche to do whatever they want to do and withdraw that benign or implicit support, then they will have a lot less power and a lot less kudos than they have. So there's no going back for them now. It's like Stonewall. You know, Stonewall will fall. We will see the end of Stonewall. The rot set in a long time ago, and there's no way to save it anymore. And I do believe that some institutions and big organisations need to be metaphorically burned to the ground and built back up in a different form. And I include universities in this. I think some of them are just too far gone. But we are getting to the end of it. And we have shown the world, apparently, Turf Island, we're an inspiration around the world. We've shown them that there is a way forward and that, thankfully, you know, we are an example of never giving up.
Yeah, I really agree. And I'm always quite optimistic about the future. And I'm pretty certain that in the future, people will look back on Turf Island as one of the most important movements for women's rights ever. I mean, you know, I'm sure when the suffragettes were around, people looked down their noses at them as well. And history has recorded things slightly differently. Okay, my last question for you, Julie, which kind of pertains to that to a certain extent. As I was reading your book and reading the profile of you in the Sunday Times and just listening to you talk over the past few years, I often find myself wondering, is Julie Bindall in danger of becoming a national treasure? And is that something that you've thought about and considered? Is it something that scares you? What how do you feel about that?
Well, absolutely not. Definitely not a national treasure material. I live with someone who very probably is a national treasure. And that's, I think, the right way round. I'll just be there agitating and never being part of that elite establishment. I mean, I have a very privileged life and, you know, I'm in the media and I live in a nice house in North London, all of those things. I'm not pretending that, you know, I'm still the semi-feral person that I was in my youth. But no to the national treasure. But what would be nice is if people stop thinking that they can call me and the likes of me, who have actually spent quite a lot of time, unpaid time, throughout my adult life, fighting for the rights of other women, including lesbians and gay men, if they just stop calling me a Nazi and a bigot. I mean, maybe they could try out things like one of those mid-range dictators for a change, you know, rather than just go straight to Hitler. You know, anything would be an improvement. But I think that would be nice to never be called a Nazi and a bigot again.
Julie, thank you very much.
Thank you.